Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Office of the President of Malta entitled The Astronomical Observatory at the Grand Master's Palace. This talk is delivered by Professor Frank Ventura.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You see, they blame us Maltese that times we are a bit afraid of the weather, but it seems that we are courageous enough today, not only in 1565. This evening, as you know, Professor Frank Ventura will deliver his talk on the Astronomical Observatory. It's here at the palace. Right? He is lecturer at the university in sciences, of course, and definitely he's also involved in the small but very active and interesting Astronomical Society of Malta. Eh?
Good evening. So today's talk is about the Astronomical Observatory at this palace over here. I mean, and the dates are there. I mean, so it's the late 18th century. Okay, perhaps somebody can ask, well, what about astronomy and the Knights of St. John? Well, is this possible? I mean, it seems to be incongruous. I mean, it seems to be that there's no connection. But this is not so. It isn't incongruous, as we shall see. First of all, one must remember that the order had a formidable navy, and it was essential for the officers of the fleet to have a good knowledge of navigation. And navigation means astronomy. Okay? And the knights definitely made sure that all prospective officers of the navy knew their astronomy very well. What's the evidence for this? First of all, we have a book in the 16th century. It's called Opusculum Geographicum Rarum. It's a rare book on geography, but a lot of it is about astronomy. Okay, it's by Johannes Meriti, a Maltese, all right, born of Rhodian parents. Sort of when the knights came over from Rhodes, I mean, they brought a number of officers with them and a number of officials. And Johannes Meriti was the son of one of these. The book is an exquisite book. I mean, it has some movable parts, and you can learn astronomy from it. I mean, at least the astronomy of the 16th century. And then we have Grandmaster Lascaris, who established the class of mathematics with the purpose of its application to navigation. Again, navigation, astronomy. Later on, Grandmaster Carafa ensured the revitalization of the class, again for the same purpose, navigation and, of course, astronomy. Later on, we have Perellos. Perellos was a grandmaster, okay, at the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century. First of all, he has strengthened the fleet. Okay, he ordered a number of ships of the line with 50 cannons, for example, for each ship. And of course, I mean, he made sure that the technology and the science that was needed to maintain these ships and to get them going, I mean, was there also. So he established a school dedicated to navigation, pilotage, and related subjects. And we know that the tutor of the school, the main tutor of the school, was an engineer from Lecce, but he called himself Oriundo Maltese, probably nationalized Maltese. Okay? His book is, well, he wrote a number of books, four of them on advanced mathematics, which he used to teach at the school. All right? And the other one was Trattato della Sfera. Trattato della Sfera, is, half of it is astronomy, and there's quite a bit of it, and the other half is pilotage, sort of moving around with the ships. And then we have Grandmaster Pinto, who added the School of Advanced Mathematics in and the Art of Navigation at the university. So at a higher level, they used to teach mathematics and also navigation, including astronomy. Now, another aspect of astronomy and the knights concerns this room, where we are over here, all right? And there was this line. It's a meridian line, you can see that, okay, made in marble, laid from that window over there to that window over there. okay, with a hole in the ceiling, probably somewhere over there, okay? And when it was noon, the image of the sun used to cross this line, and as it crossed the line, it was noon. Probably it was used to regulate the watches and the clocks that there are in the palace. So it was the meridian line of Malta, most probably. And what happened was then, when one of the governors, changed this room into a ballroom. It was a ballroom, as you see it over there, or part of it. It was changed into a ballroom, and this meridian was removed. By 1933, we know that there were parts of it still in a lumber room somewhere in the palace, and it was known that some of the pieces had been lost. It was inlaid marble with zodiacal signs, numbers, and so on. A pity. But I've been informed very lately that it seems that there are some pieces somewhere. I don't know where this somewhere is, and I haven't seen them yet, but perhaps next talk somewhere else, I'll speak about this this meridian in more detail. Again, another picture of the meridian, this time with the chandeliers covered. In any case, and here we have a plan of the piano nobile of the palace. Okay, you can see the line showing the meridian. So we know exactly where it was. Okay, now let's go to the astronomical observatory. Who came up with the proposal of having an observatory? And there were a number of people involved. First of all, this person, okay, Diodat de Dolomieu, that's his short name. Okay, his name is much longer than that, but let's forget about the actual name. He was enlisted in the order at the age of 10, okay, when he in the minority area of the order, the branch for minor sort of knights, as it were. Anyway, as a page boy, most probably. Eventually, he became knight commander of the Lang of Auvergne when he was just 30 years old. At 33, he became lieutenant general of that order, and that meant that he would be the general of the order, of the army of the order. But this created a lot of envy among his colleagues, and there was a lot of aggro, in fact. And he had left Malta a little bit later than 1783. But he was a prominent mineralogist and geologist, a very prominent person there. And he discovered a new mineral. He found that one of the calcareous minerals that he had found, when you add acid to it, you don't get such a great effervescence. And he said, well, this is different. And eventually they found that it was a completely new mineral, and they called it dolomite for him. As we know, the mountains in Italy, northern Italy, there are the Dolomite Mountains. They are named for this, our knight of Malta. He was also, and this is quite important, he was elected associate of the Académie des Sciences in Paris in 1778, and eventually a resident member of the Academy. Okay, quite a prestigious Academy. Okay, and this is Diodat Dolomieu again, later. And I want to refer to his book, Voyage aux Îles de Lipari. And this is, he refers to the Aeolian Islands, where he went there to study volcanoes. Anyway, but that's not important for us. What is important, that he says that with this book, there is an addition of two memoirs. One of them is the memoir Sur la température du climat de Malte. So it is about the temperature and the climate of the Maltese Islands. And in this book, he says, there is no other country where the sky is so clear, where the stars shine with great brilliance, where one observes better the celestial objects with the unaided eye, and where the moon shines so brightly. It should be the land of astronomers. Then he goes on to say, Well, in Malta, you have the sky, which is clear for 6 months of the year, and the other 6 months, all right, it could be cloudy, but you can make one or two observations a night. So this is really a place where we should have astronomy. And then I suppose he persuaded the Grand Master. In fact, he says all these advantages have persuaded the Grand Master to establish an observatory. This prince has asked me to purchase the best instruments to equip the observatory for him. And eventually, he said, well, the observatory will bring as much honor to the Grand Master as it will be useful to science. And who was this Grand Master? Well, there he is, Grand Master Derouin, Emmanuel Derouin Paul Duc, Grand Master between 1775 and 1797. Again, Dolomieu tells us that the Grand Master encourages the sciences, and he had a particular interest in astronomy. Now, I don't find this very surprising, because before he became Grand Master, he was the Captain General of the Fleet of the Order. So really, I think he knew his astronomy quite well. Right. The other personage which is involved is this person, Jean-Auguste Tangos, all right, a captain in the army of Navarre, a friend of Dolomieu, and Dolomieu, I mean, proposed him to become the director of the observatory, and the Grand Master accepted. Now, Tangos, again, he was also a sort of a member of the Academy of Sciences, at a lower order of that of Dolomieu, who was a correspondent. And a correspondent of the Academy is also a sort of membership of the Academy. He was a correspondent of Charles Messier, a very famous astronomer. We still speak about him today. I mean, he was famous for his discovery of comets and so on. All right? And later, he was also elected associate of the Academy of Sciences, Sciences et Belles Lettres et Art of Rouen. So this person was known to the other scientists. We know that he made a number of calculations before he came to Malta of comets that had been found, of planets and so on. So he had a very good grasp of mathematics. He also made other observations, for example, of the Aurora Borealis, of tides, and so on. So we know about these observations that he reported to the Academy of Sciences. And the other person involved is this, Joseph Jérôme de Lalande. He was a resident member of the Academy of Sciences, right from the very beginning, from the institution of the Academy, a very famous astronomer. He wrote quite a number of books about astronomy. And he was not simply a member of the Academy of Sciences of Paris, but also of London, which means the Royal Society, all right, and Berlin, St. Petersburg, and others. So quite a reputable and very well-known person. At the time, Déodat Dolomieu contacted Lalande for advice about the observatory. We know this by a letter that Dolomieu wrote in June 1782. Actually, it was in reply to a letter which Lalande had sent to Dolomieu. Anyway, but Dolomieu told him, well, I will be in Paris in the winter of 1782, and I would like to speak to you about the observatory that we are going to have in Malta, and you will be glad to know that you are going to have Tangos as the director of the observatory. Well, all right. So that's the decision. Now, what about the building and equipping of the observatory? Well, this is a page from the accounts of the order for the period May-Maggio del 1783 a tutto ottobre, from May 1st of May to the 31st of October. And what do we find? We find that on the 16th May, there's a payment of 1,002 scudi and more, I mean, 1,000 scudi, tari, and some grani, for the admission of Jean-Auguste Dancon into the Lang of Provence. So this tells us, I think, that Dangos was in Malta by that time. Okay? And in 4 June 1783, there's a payment of 283 scudi to Dangos. We don't know for what, but it's by the order of the Grand Master. These are the two entries over there. Then, we have, on the 24th October 1783, payment of 500 scudi for iron works. So the blacksmith gets paid for the works that he does in the palace, for the copper that he used for the tin sheets, and for work on the tower. Okay, so the observatory must have been there. So we know from other sources that it was over there. On the 31st October, there's payment of 1,589 scudi. Probably it was quite a lot of money, I suppose. For woodworks, including the daily wages and the cost of wood, nails, and other materials needed for the building of the observatory. It's all written down here in these two entries. And then we have a payment of 4,228 scudi, 8 tari and 4 grani for masonry works in the palace, including the observatory. Here, this is the other entry. It is prestato nella nuova fabbrica fatta in palazzo per l'orologio, l'osservatorio e per la nuova fontana. So at that time there was some works going on the clock, okay, on the observatory and the new fountain in the palace. All right. The masonry works, the payments were made weekly, and we have how much it cost weekly, all right, between May and October. And the payments were made to the master masons and to their employees, and it includes the cost of cartloads of stones, two types of stones, it seems, di misura and ordinaria, so probably ashlar stones and some rubble stones, I don't know. Anyway, and for the transport of materials and the other expenses. And we have the list, as we said, of weekly payments. So there is a record there of the work going on between May, and it seems that the work ended end of October. By end of October, we have the observatory ready. And in fact, we also know from a letter that Dangos sends to a friend of his, Gioieni, in Sicily, that, yes, the observatory will soon be ready, and we can commence with our observations. Where was the observatory? In this area, there's the palace, and there's the tower of the palace. I don't know whether you can see the dome. Yeah. All right. And this is a reconstruction. Well, it's a drawing by Stephen Spiteri. Okay, so and you can see that here we have, close to the flags, we have this dome. At least this is how he interpreted the image that we saw before. Okay, what was the purpose of the observatory? Lalande told them very clearly, look, the main purpose should be to produce a better catalogue of the stars visible from the northern hemisphere. Okay? This was the main purpose of the observatory. Now, one must remember that we are speaking about 1783. Okay? At that time, there wasn't a very good map of all the sky, all the stars in the northern hemisphere. In fact, in 1781, William Herschel in England had found a new, what he thought was a comet. Okay? But when other scientists did the calculations, the mathematicians did the calculations of the motion of this comet, they found that it wasn't a comet at all, but it was the new planet, the planet Uranus. So all of a sudden, the solar system grew, well, immensely, almost double the size of what it was before. Again, and it was found that there were several other people before William Herschel who had seen this planet, okay, but they mistook it for a star. But since they didn't have a good star atlas, they didn't know whether it was a new star or whatever. They just said it's a star. Okay? So it was very important to have a very good catalog of all the stars. The second purpose was to discover any new, let me call them transient phenomena, for example, comets, for example, new stars, novae. Sometimes a star explodes and you get a bright star, it stays there for a number of weeks, let's say, and then it fades away. These are transient phenomena which appear in the skies. And also, it was important to keep meteorological records and making observations of any other unusual celestial phenomena. So those were the purposes of the observatory. What about the instruments? And now here we get something interesting, I think. First of all, we must remember that 1774, the order already possessed an unspecified number, we don't know how many, of astronomical and mathematical instruments, which were deposited in the new biblioteca. We know that the library, which is now in the biblioteca, was somewhere else. I think it was called Forfantone House, a little bit further away. But when the building of the biblioteca was finished, okay, they took all the things, all the books and all the things that were there and deposited them in the biblioteca. And among them it is recorded that there were astronomical and mathematical instruments. Just that. What they were, well, we don't know. But another interesting note is this, that in April 1781, again we get this from the Book of Accounts, the clockmaker Salvatore Michalef, who used to regulate the clocks of the palace, was paid by the treasury for three cannocchiali and a telescopio. Now, what is cannocchiali and what is telescopio? Not binoculars. Probably he's referring to two kinds of telescope. One would be a telescope where you have two lenses, a lens at the front and a lens at the back, okay? And the other one is a telescopio with a reflecting mirror. Probably, I would say, but probably that. But again, this is before the observatory has been set up, 1781. Dangos could have brought a telescope with him and perhaps other instruments, but it's not mentioned anyway. And then we know that on the 6th August, 1784, Joseph Jérôme de Lalande, who Dolomieu had contacted in Paris, remember, for advice about it, he sent to Malta, it's recorded in his account of astronomy in the year 1784, that he sent a 3-foot quadrant by Meni to Malta. And this had been ordered by Dolomieu in 1782. It took 2 years to make this quadrant. It used to take quite a long time, I mean, for various reasons, to make these precise instruments. And of course, we know that other instruments were ordered, as there were plans for, and there were plans for acquiring a larger quadrant than the 3-foot one that we have. What is a quadrant? It consists of a quarter circle, as you can see, graduated here, degrees, okay? We have this part here, I think it was just for keeping it level, making sure that it was precisely horizontal. And this is the telescope, okay, with which you look at the object to measure their positions. And here you have gears and devices to move the telescope as precisely as possible. We have here quadrants, actual quadrants, okay, made of brass and iron at the Paris Observatory. This was taken, I think, 2 years ago. And this is a quadrant by Pierre Meunier. Now, this quadrant, okay, in 1779, Pierre Meunier, and here we have a problem. There were two Pierre Meuniers. One is Pierre Meunier, and the other one is Pierre Bernard Meunier. One is called the senior, and the other is called the younger. Probably, we are referring to Pierre Meunier, the older, or the senior, probably. I mean, Pierre Meunier won a competition by the Académie des Sciences, for the construction of the best quadrant. It was a competition, and the chief instrument maker of the Academy, okay, had died, and they wanted to hold the competition instead of appointing somebody by interview. I mean, all right, construct a quadrant, the best quadrant will win the prize, and you become the engineer. Actually, this was the best quadrant that was made, but he only got half the prize. So perhaps it wasn't as I don't know, accurate or sophisticated as the Academy had decided. But still, he was a very, very good instrument maker. And the quadrant, this actual quadrant, which won the prize, is now, well, it was bought by a certain Cagnoli, who lived in Verona, and eventually it ended up in the Museo della Specola of the Department of Astronomy of the University of Bologna. Okay? And the iron stand that we see is modern. Well, this is all of that age of 1779, but the iron stand is reconstructed. I would like to thank Professor Fabrizio Bonoli. I got to know that this instrument is over there, and I told him, have you got a photograph of it? And he actually sent me one the next day. So it was very, 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 very kind and very nice. And what about the instrument for Malta? The instrument for Malta, the 3-foot quadrant sent to Malta, had an additional device to the one that had won that prize, all right? And this device allowed the reading of angles to the nearest 2 or 3 seconds of arc. Now, I think you all know that 1 degree is a very small size, all right? But just to give you an idea, in the sky, the full moon is 30 minutes wide, so 1,800 seconds. Now, this instrument could measure 1/60th of that, 1/60th the diameter of the moon. So it could put a star to a precision of an angle of just a very tiny bit. And the Journal des Savants, where this was reported, tells us that this precision had not been attained before by quadrants of this size. So it was something new. And also we know that the price of the instrument, we don't know how much it cost, but the price of the instrument was proposed by the Academy of Sciences. All right. Then in February 1785, it tells us that there was a hope. I don't know what that means, but there was a hope that the Palace Observatory would acquire a large 8-foot mural quadrant. Imagine, sort of, this would be 8 foot high. Okay? It would be placed on a wall, and the wall would be exactly facing south. Or there were some cases where the wall was built on a sort of stand or a platform, and the platform could be rotated so that it faces exactly south. And the astronomer would then observe from this telescope, from this end over here, okay, and see when the stars cross the meridian, exactly when a star crosses the south meridian. When that happens, he records the time, he records the angle, and who would know exactly where that star is in the heavens, all right? And such an instrument It can be used to, it could be used to produce a complete catalogue of the stars with a precision of less than 1 second of arc, and that's very, very precise. Even today, I mean that's a very good precision. As a byline, astronomers are never happy with the catalogues they have and with the star charts that they have, and we always send up a new, satellite, to record the stars with greater precision. Anyway, the latest one was, I think, a month ago. It was called Gaia, and it's supposed to be looking at the positions and also in three dimensions of about a billion stars. So you can imagine. All right. What about the other instruments of the observatory? We know, again from a letter by Dolomieu, that in September 1783, Dolomieu and Dangos had postponed the visit to Sicily, to Mount Etna, in fact, because the instrument they had ordered from England and Florence had not yet arrived. So we know that there were instruments ordered there. We also know that in August 1784, the observatory acquired a copper tube with lenses for a telescope, 80 scudi, an English achromatic telescope, 30 scudi. And by the way, this was something new. I mean, achromatic lenses, which means they are really, it's a lens where you have a crown lens and the lens of a lens of a certain type of glass and another lens of a different type of glass stuck together. I mean, achromatic to reduce the color distortion that occurs if you use a single lens. If you use a single lens, it could act as a prism, and a prism, disperses the light, and you get you don't get a bright spot. You get a spot with some color around it. Now, if you have two lenses of different glass, you can reduce that color immensely. This was discovered, these type of glasses were made around about 1770, so this was something new, getting an achromatic telescope. And it was in England that they made the best achromatic lenses. They also acquired a hygrometer and a thermometer from Geneva. 7 graduated enamel circles, 32 scudi, so a circle with graduations on it, and other equipment including convex lenses, springs for a pendulum, and a tube for a barometer. So we get some idea of what the equipment of the observatory was. Okay. Interest in an observatory, I should say unusual interest in the observatory. Well, why should the Inquisitor be interested in the observatory? But as soon as he got to know that there was Dangos here in Malta and that an observatory was going to set up, he sent a letter to the secretary, to the Secretariat of State at the Vatican, saying that, well, an observatory is going to be established and we are going to have a director who was proposed by Lalande. Okay, now, I don't know, Lalande was a Mason, a Freemason, and so was Dolomieu, and it appears that so also was Dangos. So, I don't know, there could be that connection there. And also, and this is again very strange, the Russian Count Chernyshev is recorded as having visited what he calls the newly established observatory and found it packed with mathematical and physical instruments. But what is interesting is that this happens in June 1782. I don't know, a year before the observatory I'm talking about. So was there an observatory before? This the observatory. Well, that's something which we need to look into, at some other stage. Okay, what were the observations? What observations do we know about? Right. So, the first observation we know about, which is recorded, is this. I suppose you can see that here we have
the moon and some stars.
Okay, the astronomers here know what that constellation is. I mean, if we put lines like that, this is the half of the constellation of Scorpius, the scorpion. Well, this is the head of the scorpion, this is the heart of the scorpion, it's called. In any case, you can see that the moon is very close to a star, all right? And what happens? If you follow that, you see that the moon gets even closer to the star, and eventually it occults the star. This is called an occultation. The star is called Pi Scorpii, and it happened at 9 hours, 31 minutes, 18 seconds, recorded by Dangos, and from that, he calculates the longitude of the palace. And he says, well, the longitude of my observatory is this. He gives if we take modern figures, I mean, it tells us that the observatory is at a longitude of 14 degrees, 27 minutes from Greenwich, okay? Actually, the measurements he gave was from Paris. But if you take modern measurements, that's what he says it is. It's not very accurate, by the way. It's understandable, because if it's based on just one, observation, it wouldn't be that accurate. And again, we don't know what clocks he used. Because this is very important. It's very important that you get the time very precisely. So we know about the instruments, I mean the telescopes, etc., that he had, but not about the clocks. You need a chronometer, really, which is very precise to make a very good observation of this type. Okay. Then, on the 20th January 1784, Dangos discovers, I put it within inverted commas, and I say within inverted commas because at first it was thought that it was Dangos who first discovered this comet, but eventually it was found that there were other people who had seen it, some of them before him, others after him, and in fact, the discovery of this comet is not attributed to anybody. Okay, it is said, well, there were so many observations, we discovered the comet. It was called the Great Comet, quite bright. It had a coma. The coma is the head of the comet. The head was about 33 seconds of arc, and it had a tail of 2 or 3 degrees. I put a photograph there, which is about, I think, the size that the comet had, the comet that he observed had. I think it was called the Great Comet, not because it was very bright. Well, it was quite bright. You could see it with your naked eye. But because they could observe it from January up to May. So it was quite a long period of time. Well, fine. They said, look, I mean, this report in the journal, the Savants of the Academy of Sciences said, the observatory of the Grand Master has started to become very useful to science. All right? It already shows a promise. So, fine. And the discovery of this comet made it into this book, the Cometographie, or Traité historique et théorique de comet. It's about, this is written by a certain Pingré, and it was one of the, what shall I call it? It was the book on comets. All right? It was the major book on comets. And it made it here, and it's called The First Comet of 1784. Okay. Then, 11th April, 1784, Dangos reports the discovery of a new comet. Can you see the comet? All right, fine. For those who can't see it, there's it. There it is. And he says, it's small, and this is how he describes it. I have discovered a new comet on 11th April in the constellation Vulpecula. It is very small, without a tail, and a slightly nebulous appearance, so it's cloudy. Right? I took it for a nebula, But I determined the exact position. And then he says, the next day I couldn't see it. The day after it was cloudy. The day after it was, again, I couldn't see it. And then I saw it again on the 15th. But on the 13th, he said, I saw it just for a few moments, but I could see that it had moved. And this was, this is the telling thing about comets. So one day you see them here, next day they move, all right? The next day they move and you go on. So he made sure it was a comet, and then he made a very, I observed it very well today on the 15th. I judged it a little brighter. This is a part, this is an excerpt from a letter which he sent to Messier, Charles Messier, remember, his correspondent at the Academy of Sciences. This letter was written on the 15th of April, and the letter arrived in Paris on the 14th of May, a month later. And this is what Messier says about it. So he received Dankos's letter with two positions a month later, so the position for the 11th April and the position for the 15th April. With two positions a month later. He searched for the comet in the area, reported by Dankos, but he could not see, he could only see a small nebula, which is now known as M27. M stands for Messier, by the way. I mean, today that's what we call it, Messier 27, which he had discovered some time before, just to give you an idea. With two positions only, you cannot calculate the orbit of a comet. To calculate the orbit of a comet, you need three, at least, three positions. So with two, it's not enough. This is M27, very small, nebulous, all right? And I suppose that the reference by Charles Messier to M27 implies that, perhaps Dankos, mistook M27 for a comet. I think it implies that. In any case, this is the report, the actual report from the Journal des Savants. It says, I have discovered a new comet on the 11th April in the constellation of Renard, which is the Vulpecula. It is very small, without tail, and a light appearance of nebulosity. And it goes on and on and on. Okay. And then he gives the two positions here, 11th April, 15th April. Okay. Then, in February 1785, about 10 months later, he published his calculations of the elements of the comet, sort of its inclination, how far it passed close to the sun, when it passed close to the sun, and so on. The orbit of the second comet. And he reported that these calculations were based on observations he made of the comet between 11th April and the 1st and 1st May. All right, so very clear. He says that very clear. However, he did not report the exact positional measurements that he made in addition to the two that he had published on the 11th April, and which were sent to Messier and published by Pingré. Okay, we also know that he observed sunspots. Now, I know this is not a very good photograph of sunspots, but this is what you see when you use a very small telescope. Okay, you can see the sun here. Okay, with a spot, with two spots. There's a spot here and a spot there, but you can see some detail, all right, in the two of them. These are sunspots that appeared last month. Also, he observed what we call the zodiacal light. Now, what's the zodiacal light? You can see this either an hour before sunrise, or an hour after sunset. And you can see that there's a glow, as it were, in the sky. It sometimes is described as a pyramid of light. And in the 1780s, nobody knew the nature of this zodiacal light. They didn't know what it was. So Dan Gos thought it was very important to make observations of it on as many days as possible. And he says that the zodiacal light is visible from Malta on many days of the year. Well, if you can see it, perhaps we can brighten it up a bit, and that's what you get, okay, that glow. Okay, other observations? Well, Ptolemy told him, keep an eye on Etna. Make sure that if there's going to be an eruption, tell me, so that I'll go to Sicily and follow the eruption. And this is, by the way, a photograph of the eruption of Etna, the latest eruption of Etna. It's taken from Gozo by Dr. Michael Molle, all right, who very generously gave me permission to use this photograph. You can see the lava flowing. Unbelievable, oh? Unbelievable. Anyway, another interesting observation that he made was this. A very strange observation of atmospheric refraction, a mirage. On the 20th March, he says, 1784, at 13 hours, Dangos heard a hubbub in the streets, as people thought that an island had emerged in the sea close to Malta. In fact, some fishermen had already went out in their boats to take possession of it. Brave fellows, eh? Anyway, he went up to the observatory, confirmed the observations, and he found that the island, what they called an island, appeared in the direction of Mount Etna, and it had the shape of a truncated cone. So it couldn't be anything but Mount Etna. But an image of Mount Etna, but a very strange thing. It appeared very close to Malta. Then he says, this phenomenon was repeated on the 17th April, 1785, at 6:10 in the morning, okay? And this time it lasted throughout the day. He could see it throughout the day. And he made measurements of it. He took the angle of depression, okay? And he said, well, it looks as if it is only 18 kilometers away from Malta. So really, it looked very, very close. Anyway, now, so that's what was happening in the observatory. Then, 1789, disaster. A fire destroys the observatory. And we know, in the night, during the night of the 13th to the 14th March, 1789. We know this from a number of sources. Ptolemy writes a letter to his friend and says, look, the observatory caught fire. There's a letter from the Inquisitor to the Vatican. Again, 14th March, by the way. As soon as he got to know about the observatory being burnt, he wrote this letter. A note in the memoirs of the Academy of Sciences, it's here, and a letter by Dango to the Secretary of the Academy in 1805, much, much later. Okay? We know about the fire. What were the consequences of the fire? Well, first of all the astronomical records were lost, including 20 years of observations that Dango had made over a number of years, not just those in Malta, okay, and which were ready for publication. He says, by 1786, they were already finished, ready for publication. I was going to publish them in Italy. Secondly, some meteorological records survived, as they were in a different room, not in the observatory. And then, however, controversy erupted about the cause of the fire. What caused the fire? Dangos tells us, and Ptolemy tells us also, that it was lightning. So lightning struck the observatory, and it caught fire. Some others said, no, it wasn't lightning. Dangos was making some experiment with phosphorus, and an accident happened, and the observatory caught fire. Which one is correct? Well, we don't know. But I can tell you that if you are working with white phosphorus, I used to teach chemistry for a number of years, but if you work with white phosphorus and you forget to put it under water, okay, and you leave it there, it will burn. Huh? it will catch fire, and the, by the way, the temperature becomes very, very high. It's not surprising that things will burn, things closer it will burn. The other consequence was that Dangos was discouraged. He left Malta for Tarbes, where he used to live, in southern France, and where he made other observations and taught mathematics at the École Centrale des Hautes-Pyrénées, and later he became the librarian of the municipal library of Tarbes. Okay? There's, again, a lot of things to say about this, but it's not the purpose of the talk today. Well, 20 years, 21 years, and say 22 years after the discovery of the second comet, queries started to be made about it. 1806, French astronomer Burckhardt, who was a very good mathematician and calculating the orbits of comets, he asked the permanent secretary of the Academy of Sciences, look, can you tell me whether there are any other observations of the comet besides the two positions reported in Pingre? And Delambre, the permanent secretary, wrote to Dangos and told him and asked him, well, do you have any other observations? And Dangos writes a very long letter in which he says, look, if there aren't observations published in Pingre, there weren't other observations. I have some meteorological journals with me, and from them I can say that after the 15th, the sky was completely misty, you couldn't make observations, and definitely there were no other observations made. Besides those two which were published. And he says, look, I could see the zodiacal light on April 22nd, but then no observation was possible. So Burckhardt said, all right, let me see what I can do with these two observations that I had. And he made various hypotheses, but none of the solutions that he came up with could tally with what Dangos had published earlier. Okay, fair enough. However, later, this is after 1806, it was discovered that Dangos had published another 14 observations of the comet, of the second comet, which had made up to the 1st May 1784. And these were in an obscure German periodical of 1786. So another 14 observations were discovered. This discovery immediately raised suspicions about the authenticity of the observations that he had made originally. And a number of prominent astronomers and mathematicians became involved in an in-depth investigation of this case over a number of years. The first one was this, the first famous astronomer, Johann Franz Encke, a German, who was famous for his calculation of a short period comet, and later he became director of Berlin Observatory and professor of mathematics in Berlin. Now, one of his characteristics, his biographer says that one of his characteristics was his severity with others, but he was even more severe with himself. So it gives us an idea of the personality of this guy. Now, what Encke did was to take those 14 observations that had been found and try to fit an orbit. And he fitted the orbit, but very surprisingly said, I can reproduce Dangos' 14 observations only if he used exactly 10 times too large a value of the Earth's distance from the Sun. So if you take the distance from the Earth to the Sun 10 times as much as it is, exactly, then you can fit an orbit. And of course, Encke said, these are made up. Dangos just made some calculations on paper and says that he has discovered a comet. So his judgment was this. Dangos had the audacity to forge observations he never made of a comet that he had never seen, based on an orbit he gratuitously invented, all to give himself the glory of having discovered a comet. And that's something. Anyway, luckily for Mangos, this very famous mathematician came to his sort of support, let's say. This is Carl Friedrich Gauss. We still use today Gaussian statistics. So he was a very famous. He was called, in fact, the prince of mathematicians by other mathematicians, of course. And he is known as one of history's most influential mathematicians. Now, Gauss taught that Encke, by the way, who was his student, I mean, Gauss had taught, anyway, but Gauss taught that Encke was too hasty and harsh in his judgment of Dangos. Although he considered the deception very probable, he hesitated to pronounce Dangos guilty until there was proof positive. And what does this mean? In fact, Gauss was more cautious and humane in his judgment. And in a letter to another astronomer, he expressed his belief that there was no conclusive proof of guilt. And this is, and he says this, and this is one of his most quotable quotes. If you go through Google, by the way, and say Gauss, you'll find that this quote right there. It says, "I take the expression proof, not in the sense of lawyers, who set two half-proofs equal to one whole, but in the sense of a geometer, where half a proof equals zero. And it is demanded for every proof that every doubt becomes impossible." So, there you are. Another person who came to the help, let's say, or of Dangos was Heinrich Ludwig d'Arrest, again a German. He was a co-discoverer of the planet Neptune. Anyway, d'Arrest accepted that Dangos comet observation cannot apply to an orbit around the sun. So if you try to fit an orbit with those, you don't fit it. But then he said, but it could be that the comet came so close to the Earth that for some time it was as if it were a satellite of the Earth. And he said, but to do this, you need to make this calculation, and the calculation is very, very complicated. But this hypothesis, he tried to save Dangos. However, well, what do you think? Some people describe this comet as an enigma, a cause célèbre, all right, an egregious error. Sometimes these type of errors were called angosiad for Dangos, or a shameful invasion. Probably number three. I think it was number four. Again, based on other evidence that I have. Because he made other observations in Tarb, where one of these observations was that when looking at the sun, when observing the sun for sunspots, he saw an opaque object crossing the sun. Okay? And he said, "I saw something like this in Malta. It must have been," he says, "1st October 1784. And then he said, "This could be connected to a comet which appeared in 1672. And the German astronomer immediately said, "Let us look at these dates. These dates are all 14 years apart. 14 years, 14 years, 14 years, 14 years. Again, Dangos is making up another orbit, okay, with exactly 14 years. And okay, so probably, unfortunately, it was probably a shameful invention. Anyway, a sequel, and we'll end very quickly with this. What happened to the instruments and the building of the observatory? Thomas McGill, who writes a guide to Malta, and Blanche Linton Simmons, again, I think she's the daughter of one of the governors of Malta. They wrote a book about Malta and about the palace. And they, both of them referred to the instruments of the observatory in the tower after 1800. First of all, they say they had a value of 500 lire. Sorry, 5,000. Sorry. Okay, lire, I don't know, or pounds. Anyway, that they were secreted in the entresol of the tower when the French came in 1798. So when the French invaded, somebody took these instruments and hid them in between two of the rooms of the palace. Okay? They were discovered by Captain Smith, the surveyor, in 1816. And where we presume they still are. Anyway. And they also speak about the round house from where the astronomer made his observation was converted by Sir Alexander Ball into a place for keeping signals. So this is where the tower is today. Another bit of information is this. Lieutenant, at the time in 1804, Charles Passley, later he became General Sir Charles Passley, it was reported that in October, November 1804, Lieutenant Passley of the Royal Engineers was responsible nella comatatura del Gran Telescopio at the palace. So in the maintenance of the telescope at the palace in 1804. Then in one of his books, Passley states that he had invented the system of polygrammatic telegraph signals. It was sort of you get a pole with two arms, as it were. I don't know whether any of you was in the Boy Scouts. I was in the Boy Scouts, and somehow we had a semaphore signal. That's an A with a flag, that's a B, that's a C, that's a D, that's an E, and so on, and that's a T or whatever. Anyway, but you have a pole with four sets of these. He invented this type of signals. Later it was used in England for the railway system. Okay, the railway signals. He invented the system that was used. And he invented this when he was in Malta. He records that. And he says, I had communicated my system to a number of people, and among them to Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And Samuel Taylor Coleridge lived for some time in this palace, in the room just below the observatory. Okay? Samuel Taylor Coleridge records that. So they must have had some communication. But what is important here is that he maintained the Gran Telescopio that was found in the palace. I don't suppose that it was used for astronomical observation, but for observing signals at a far point. I don't know, Nadur, for example, Nadur Heights, Nadur in Malta, I mean, or perhaps in Gozo also. I mean, you get the signals from there. And who was the surveyor that the Bagel spoke about? It's this. His captain, W.H. Smith, later he became admiral. Now, he was involved in making a hydrographic maps of the Mediterranean. Okay? Sort of sounding the sea, how deep it is, and so on in several places. And he says, Malta was the station whence all my runs since the year 1816 were carried and valued. As the chronometers, and this is important, as the chronometers were always rated at anchor wharf in the dockyard and transported from thence by triangulation to the palace in Valletta. I don't know how to read this exactly or what it means, but it could mean that the chronometer, sort of the precise clocks at anchor wharf, were regulated by the meridian that we had over here. So the meridian was used to regulate the clocks in the palace, and then the clocks in the palace were used to regulate the clocks over there. That's possible. And later on, he says, in the same book, Memoirs of the Mediterranean, it's called, in a separate paper published in 1822, he showed how to connect coordinates, and he means geographical coordinates, on the Barbary coast with the palace at Malta. So again, I mean, there's some connection with the palace. As far as the palace is taken as a center, sort of the observation, the observatory is taken as a center for observation. This is one of his hydrographic charts. The Grand Harbor, my son shared,
And you can see all these points there.
These are the depth of the sea at those points. And have like that for the whole of Malta, Gozo, and many places in North Africa, Sicily, somewhere, all around the Mediterranean. Conclusion. The astronomical observatory in the palace had the potential to bring honor to the Grand Master and promised to contribute to the advance of astronomy. Unfortunately, I would say, the director of the observatory did not manage to fulfill this promise. He may have had the required mathematical skills, but he was, I believe, a poor observer and prone to cover his errors with fraudulent calculations. When Napoleon Bonaparte conquered Malta in 1798, he decreed that, among other things, okay, remove the university, put instead of it, found an École Centrale. And with the École Centrale, there should be an astronomical observatory attached to the École Centrale. But of course, this did not materialize, and we know why. All right, the Maltese uprising against the French, and everything stopped. And this happened to the detriment of the development of astronomy in Malta. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Office of the President of Malta, entitled The Astronomical Observatory at the Grand Master's Palace. This talk was delivered by Professor Frank Ventura.